This is the last session on Japanese culture, and it's on the concept of self. As I came in here, you said, well, we don't know what concept of self is for ourselves, so how are we going to talk about it with the Japanese, which is a very good question. You could start from our own concept or from theirs. I decided today to talk about theirs first, but I definitely want to get to a discussion of theirs as related to us, because I think one of the reasons that we study other cultures is so that we can come back and see ourselves more clearly. And in my classes, I think that's certainly one of the main points that I wish to make for the students who, you know, have mostly, I teach at Oregon State University, so they've come out of often rural Oregon and haven't thought much beyond Oregon, certainly not much beyond the United States. And so they haven't gotten much perspective on what's different or unique about us. Because we're unique, too, when looked at from the outside. So maybe we'll get to a bit of that towards the end today. I mentioned, I think, the first day when we talked about education that we had both taught in public high schools in northern Japan. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about two of the women teachers that I taught with to open up today. There was one woman, well, there weren't very many women to start with. There were, I think, six or seven full-time women teachers, besides myself, in a faculty of about 40. There are many more at the elementary school level. One of the women was an English teacher, and she was sort of assigned to me, not only because her English was good, but also because she was the only woman English teacher. And she was sort of supposed to take care of me. I met her early on when I first came in on a hot July day into the principal's office, and sat down very formally on the leather, well, probably plastic couches that they have in their sort of guest room at the schools. And she was the one who translated, because I had just come to Japan, I really didn't speak much Japanese. And she translated between the principal and myself, and there was a representative from the Board of Education. Everything was very formal. So my first impression of her was as a very serious woman. She spoke very politely, as far as I could tell, in English, and appeared to speak very politely with hands together in her lap and feet always together, knees together, and a voice that was rather high, which seemed to be a sign of politeness. And bowing, of course, when we went in and out, and very politely handing the teacup with two hands and so on. Things that I came to know after I was there for a while as signs of a very formal and polite situation. So my first impression of her was as someone who was rather restrained, certainly quiet, and very, very polite. Later on, as time went on, she had, at least at first, for about the first year, she had a desk that was next to mine. And she would often draw pictures, little cartoons, of the older men teachers. And her favorite time for doing this was during faculty meetings, when, as I mentioned before, all the women were huddled at the end of the room with this sort of long, very long and U-shaped table, with the principal at the very front, and we were at the back. And when anyone got too serious in his declarations of what he thought was right for the school, she'd start drawing him in a caricature. And even the senior home ec teacher, who was a woman, came in for her mocking in these drawings. And sometimes she'd just be shaking with laughter at my side while these people were speaking. You know, not what you're supposed to do at a faculty meeting. So I came to realize there was definitely another side to this person. Also, after a while, I got invited down to the nurse's room. Well, the nurse's room was enough off from the rest of the main faculty rooms and the student rooms that was sort of a getaway. And she and this English teacher and sometimes myself and a few of the other women teachers would gather down there and gossip or complain about whatever was going on. And there was obviously quite a different tone to what was going on. You know, no longer this polite stance, but very, really free motions. And as I came to know Japanese, much more informal language. And this is an important change that until you know the language, it's hard to be sensitive to. But in these more formal situations, all of the words are much longer on the end, and they put prefixes on the front. Sometimes they use completely different words. in order to give that sense of a more formal situation, and particularly to show deference, to show respect to those above them. Whereas if you're in an informal situation, all of the verbs, which are at the end of the sentence, get very short. You still get prefixes sometimes on the beginnings of words, but you just say things in a much quicker, and it would seem a little rougher way. I don't know quite what a good example in English. Do you have any good examples that come to your mind? Please give me the honor of having some tea. You know, might be a kind of translation for a polite Japanese sentence. Whereas in the home, here's some tea. Right. And we have those differences too, but they're just not so marked.
Or in Australia, you know, have a cuppa.
Have a cuppa, yeah, that's really good. another woman teacher who I became friends with was a calligraphy teacher. And here again, whenever she was in the faculty room, which was not too often, I might add, because she had a desk in the faculty room, but she also had her own calligraphy classroom, which was not a home room for the students. So she spent as much time as she could there, which I came to understand why. but whenever she was in the teacher's room, she made sure that she poured tea for all of the men and brought it, and women teachers actually too, and brought it around. And this was ordinarily a female job, but she did it with great flourish and bowed lower than everyone else and used more polite language, always was laughing with her hand over her mouth, which is the polite way for women to laugh in Japan, and really humored the men, I felt, particularly the older men. And yet, in other parts of her life, she, one of the reasons she wanted to stay in that calligraphy room because that was her own kingdom. And she really expressed herself very freely in that situation. She would invite me over to learn some calligraphy and circle it with bright orange lines, finding a few good strokes in there. And she also gave calligraphy lessons at home, and I found out later was doing her own calligraphy in very, well, freestyle, we might say. She used a brush that was this big to do calligraphy on huge paper that she would put out in the studio in her house, and she would make very large characters on that and then enter national contests. So she was making it up the rank in calligraphy as an art. At home, she was taken care of, by her mother. She was in her 30s but had not married, and in fact when I went back later she still wasn't married, so I presume she might stay single all her life. But it was such a contrast because at school, she was such a good carer for the men in the faculty room. And when she went home, her mother cared for her with all her might, so there she could indulge herself as she might. The principal was another good example of this sort of almost wild shifting that I was noticing in people. He was educated completely before the war. I'm not sure he served in the war. Do you remember?
No,
he may have, I don't know. But he acted, I mean, his whole stance was military. Very straight back, tight-lipped, never said very much. And everyone was a little afraid of him and deferred quite well to him. However, one party I remember, and this will remind you of the kind of parties Clint was talking about earlier, as the party wore on and everyone drank more, this is called a forget-the-year party, just before the new year, they have a wild party to forget the old year. And
relatively wild for a high school.
Right, probably. Yeah. And towards the end, everybody got in a circle and was singing the school song. At the end of the song, everybody was cheering, and somebody pulled the principal down onto the floor. This is on the tatami floor in a Reed mess. And then one by one, all the men faculty piled in a heap on top of them. So here's this heap of people with the principal at the bottom. And they're all laughing and finally struggle up. And he acts probably more drunk than he is, leaning on his arm around one of the faculty going out. And that's how the party ends. But what a contrast to this gentleman who you would never dream having that kind of free action when he's in a school situation.
But was that ritualized too?
I mean, that wasn't planned at all. Is that what you mean?
No,
that was spontaneous, right? Yeah. The opening ceremony at one of those parties is planned, and he would have spoke rather formally at the beginning, but this is 3 hours later.
Right.
I don't know whether any of you are familiar with Ruth Benedict, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. This is a book that was written shortly after the war. The title itself, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. Contrast. She was hired by the American government to figure out these Japanese because it looked like we were going to win the war, but we didn't know what we were going to do with them after we won it. And we needed to have some direction on how to handle them, both during the war and then if there were an occupation at that time. She never went to Japan, but she wrote this book from interviewing prisoners of war, reading about Japan. She opens that book with many contrasts that she sees in the Japanese. And of course, being wartime, she particularly marvels at the ruthlessness that had been witnessed by so many people throughout the war, the Asian theater. And yet, in their everyday lives, real gentleness, quietness, a real appreciation of aesthetic things. And this seemed to really grab her as the problem that needed to be explained about the Japanese. She had written some other books about Native American cultures, and she seemed to be able to categorize them very well, as one was Dionysian and one was Apollonian, very wild or very sort of straight. But she wasn't able to do that with the Japanese, because she saw both sides there. And this puzzled her, and I'll tell you later what she came up with as her solution. The samurai, I think, are another example. When we read about the samurai, or even see them in movies, we see a very tough, loyal, determinedly loyal, ready to kill, self-disciplined sort of person. And yet on the other side, we see a person who enters into the tea ceremony, sometimes does the tea ceremony, writes poems, and so on. So again, we see that strong contrast. Well, after being there for the first several years, I went back to Japan for another stint to do research for my dissertation. And as I mentioned before, I was researching middle-aged women, particularly on the experience of menopause and on changes they felt at that time, but middle age is a general time in their lives. And I heard them using a word ki a lot, and by this time I could speak pretty good Japanese, so I was catching on. This is the character, of course, coming from China originally, for ki, but this character's been around for a long time in Japan. And originally, it had the idea of a universal energy. And again, we come back to that. Remember the other day we were talking about universal power. You can identify that with what I was talking about a bit. They use this word now in the word tenki, which means weather. So it still is carried on as the idea of sort of the everything around you. But now, most of the ways that this word ki is used is for the energy that's inside a person. And for a while, ki was considered to be both physical and mental, if you will, or spiritual. But now, it has changed so that the physical pretty much is not paid much attention to, at least for this word. And instead, it has more of a psychological or a spiritual kind of energy. That's the meaning that it carries. Now, I don't expect you to learn Japanese here, but I do stress that most of what I'm saying today comes out of a study that's based on linguistic concepts. I won't bore you with all of those, but it's important to realize that these are my interpretations, of course, but on the other hand, they are based on words and concepts and oppositions that Japanese themselves use. Okay, so I started talking to a number of these women, and they would say, well, when I get symptoms of menopause, my ki gets loose. Or they'd say, my ki wanders. Or they'd say, I don't have any ki energy to do things that I expect myself to have. Or some would use an expression that uses ki. I translated it as becoming selfish. It's sort of doing things the way my ki wants to, as if my ki just runs off with me. So ki has a kind of whimsicality to it. It will carry you away in your own feelings, according to the feelings of your heart, maybe, or what's a good way for us to say it? Go with our mood, maybe.
Capriciousness?
Capriciousness, yeah, it has that feeling about it. Right. So there's this side to it, and they feel at these times that they're a little bit out of control, okay? They don't want to do the dishes, even though they should do the dishes. Or they don't want to do the cleaning, even though they should clean. Or they get angry at their husbands. And sometimes they're very glad for the doctor to say, well, you've got menopause. And then they can go home and tell their husband, well, that's why I'm angry at my husband. And then they would contrast this with the way they expected themselves to be as mature women. And in this instance, they would say, what I really should be able to do is make my ki stand up straight, make my ki energy stand up straight. Or I should have ki strength, ki ryogu. Or perhaps some of you have heard this word. It means the same as ki strength, but it's more known in the West. Seishin, it's the power, the mental energy that is associated with samurai in particular. And they'll use that word. This is the way I should be. I should be able to control that ki. I should be able to get hold of it and have control over it. I should have the strength to endure things that are difficult and to fight hard if I need to, that gaman and gambaru ideas. So in this sense, the ki isn't following your mood that's inside you, but it's an energy that goes out and conforms, we might say, or acts appropriately to what's going on around you. And if the situation calls for respect to somebody or doing the tasks that are expected to you in the faculty room or in the store where you work, then that's what you'll do. And you'll control that ki so that you won't be complaining about your own problems, but you will be being focused, focusing your key. That's a good word for it. Now, I've, on the other side here, I've made a little diagram just to try to make this a little clearer. If you think of the key, which actually, the key energy, they talk of coming from the heart. And heart here is thought of as a kind of spiritual center. But they don't really have a word for a psychic center in the sense that we do. They don't use the word psyche. They have that word, but it's an import. The ki energy can be imagined as coming inside you, closer to your heart, or coming outside you to meet other people and the situation outside. On the other hand, it can become more disciplined, or it can become more spontaneous. I think what's important to realize here is that the mature person ought to be able to make all of these movements. Not always be disciplined, nor always be spontaneous, but be able to make that shift when it's necessary. So when you have these different contexts, for example, my teacher friends, in the faculty room, they will be acting in a very disciplined way, keeping control over their ki energy, conforming to the outer circumstances. Whereas when that teacher friend went to the nurse's room to gossip with her friends, then she would act in a much more spontaneous way and be expressing her more inner feelings. Now, I'm being simplistic about this. Of course, there's various levels at which people would express themselves. I think there is, I drew this little graph down here just to suggest that, you know, there are a lot of different ways that this could be expressed. It isn't always conformity to the group when you're disciplined. I think we tend to think of Japanese and often make that categorization as they're group-oriented. And we're individualistic. I mean, that's probably the most common contrast that is made. But I think we have to be a little careful of that because certainly the discipline, that control over ki energy, which they expect of themselves, also is an inner kind of thing. So that those children who are studying for exams or playing their cello or whatever, they have to have ki energy that is developing into something that they can control very well. Same way, here we have a spontaneous outer. Well, you might imagine this situation as a place where, such as Clint talked about the other day, or a party with the faculty, you can't act too outlandishly, right? This, after all, is your situation where you work. So you're expected to be spontaneous, but still to be harmonious and to conform to that harmony of the group in that situation. And he suggested that after that main party, you might go to a second party or a third party where just your friends, your best friends who were your same age were there. And this would come more into this square where you're spontaneous, but your key energy is able to express what's really closest to your heart. And so there's a variety of ways that this can express itself. The other day, you asked about privacy and private and public in Japan, and I think this relates to this. I think the private area that a person has probably is mostly expressed in this square right here, okay, where your very inner ideas and opinions and feelings can be expressed in a spontaneous way. Home is a place where often that can happen. I mean, for a woman where her work is done at home, she can't be completely spontaneous, right? She has to get the food on the table, and she might find times with her friends when she'll be more spontaneous. But on the whole, the home is a private place. Privacy, I think, used to be drawn very clearly between the household and anything else, whether that be the village, or although you could say that the village then again would be private if anybody else came into it. So there are various levels, of course, of privacy. But household definitely was one of those levels. Now, because the larger family, the extended family, doesn't live together as much, I think privacy is being expanded a bit. Friends, close friends, are being brought into the home more than they were. However, privacy is still a very respected thing in Japan. I mean, we think of them as not having privacy, but I think the way we have to think about privacy is in terms of an in-group. In other words, that group which is very close to each other. And that might be a section in a company that works very closely together, but we might think more naturally of it as a family or a household, which would be an in-group. And then, of course, if people from the out-group, if people from another company come into the room where everybody's working, or if people from another family come in, then that's the out-group, and your actions change to a certain extent.
Do the wives ever get included, like, say here, you know, they have work picnics?
Parties. That's an interesting question. They don't, no. And I can remember when we first got married, we would be going to these faculty parties, and of course we taught in different schools, and we were never invited to each other's parties. And that was sometimes a cause of some resentment and complaint on our parts. There was nothing we could do about it, because it was just unquestioned. And when I look back on it, I think it had its merits in that the emphasis was on the group of the faculty, or whatever small group of the faculty. And if spouses are there, of course it changes the kind of communication that's going on. And what's important is that group. Now the family is respected as a group, but a different group. So you can have overlapping groups and be in several groups, but nonetheless, your activities within those groups are respected and kept apart, I think. But that's a good question. Yeah. So I'd like to suggest then that the self is moving, changing in Japanese society. That to be a mature Japanese, you need to be able to discriminate very well between times that are a little more formal, where you need to show more respect for people, or times that are much more informal, and you can start to express your own opinion, or at least express emotions. So there's a kind of multiplicity there, a variousness in self in Japan, that switches according to who's present, according to the relationships that are going on, and according to the context. In other words, I could be with the same person, but we could be in a more formal situation together or a less formal situation. But this idea of changing is very important. Japanese have words to express these different kinds of contexts, and I was hearing John talk about two of them. Again, this is sort of throwing Japanese at you, which I don't need to do, but this is one that he said he uses in his Japanese classes, having people express hone, which is sort of their,
their inner thoughts.
Inner thoughts or feelings,
what
yeah.
What you really think. Yeah.
Right, what you really think. And tatemae, which is, how do you translate that?
Well,
surface.
Kind of, a kind of lip service or... Yeah, there's...
Service idea.
In English, everything has a negative connotation. But in Japanese, it's not negative at all.
That's right. When you say, you know, just sort of what you ought to think, it sounds, like you say, very negative. And I think that's an important thing to stress here. When we see the hierarchical, the disciplined, well, maybe disciplined isn't such a negative word for us, but if we get into too much hierarchy or feeling that we've got to conform to the group, that's negative for us, usually. That is seen as something that's going to make people grow and mature. And how do they mature? By getting more control over that key. So it's important for people to be in hierarchical situations. In fact, these doctors of the women who are going through menopause, usually they'll say the women have one of two problems. One, their ki is not strong enough. They haven't, or either they've lost or they haven't developed their ki control enough. And in that case, they should go back to work. Or they should get in some kind of hierarchical situation so that they'll be able to have a stronger ki. And young people, certainly, this is an idea. In the past, you were supposed to send your son away to work in another shop for a while if you were a shopkeeper, so that he would learn through hard work and hierarchy with another person how to be a mature worker, a mature human being. On the other hand, doctors might say that these women have too much control over their ki. So that's not good either. That's somebody who takes so much responsibility that they worry constantly about things. We know these kind of people too, right? always worrying about your husband's promotions or always worrying about your children's education. And then their advice is go out and get a hobby or find a friend and go shopping or whatever. And sometimes take hormones. That's a big one too, but you don't need to go with that. Yeah.
Are these, just curiosity, are these mainly male doctors that are giving advice?
There are a few women doctors, but mostly male doctors. It's like 2%.
And so are they giving advice a lot of times maybe according to society?
Oh, I think very much so.
Rather than maybe just medical?
Yeah. Menopause is such a gray area anyway. That was a bad pun, I think. But it is a gray area in that biologically or according to our medical system, it's not well defined, right? And it is such a crossover, as people recognize, between the mental and the spiritual and the physical. So realizing that, I think they fall back on a lot of the cultural explanations that are there. Yeah. Benedict, when she talked about the Japanese, used this final solution. She said that they have circles in their lives. One is the circle of obligation. In other words, those relationships in which you act the way you're supposed to act, according to what you're obligated to do, and then a circle of emotions. And when she saw Japanese men in particular able to drink and just laugh and cry and express their emotions so freely, and then at another time be completely unemotional, expressionless. This is how she came to explain it, that they contextually, by the context, keep these different parts of themselves apart. And that's how they're able to have both sides, but to have each at different times. Okay, now what kind of person does this make? What is morality in this kind of society?
It's very relative.
That's right, yeah. When we think of morality, I think, well, what are some words that come to your mind if you want to express morality? You had principles, at any rate, right? I think we expect that of ourselves, huh?
A set of values.
A set of values, yes, that we live by, right?
Justice.
Right, justice. Such things as that. That in no matter what situation, we're going to expect ourselves to live according to certain values. Or at least that's the traditional way, I think, that many of us have been raised to think about morality. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm confused by the comment about it being relative, though, because it, on the one hand, someone like, whether it's Alan Bloom or even Bella, will suggest that American individualism and the autonomy of the self is what has contributed in many ways to that sense of relativism, that we ourselves determine those values totally outside.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Outside the institutions of society or outside our communities. And it seems to me the portrait that you're painting here is that for the Japanese, there is this strong sense of connection to, in this circle of obligation, or in maybe the positive sense of this surface kind of comment, that their standards or their values to some extent, they are supremely aware of the fact that they are being set outside themselves.
At least in this more disciplined outer situation.
Right, and so
okay, that's interesting, the way you're saying that.
Mm-hmm. One would argue to some extent that the value is, you could say it's relative to the culture as a whole, or it's set, but it's certainly set outside of the self.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And determined outside of the self, and therefore not relative in the way that we talk about relativism.
Especially at a societal level.
Yeah.
We would have more different sets of value than in Japan. I think you're absolutely right on that. And so in that sense, we have relativity in the number of
people to, in fact, maybe untrained, otherwise unformed people, to whom they can inculcate their own corporate identity. Every Japanese corporation feels it's a little different from the others. Whether or not it really is, the fact they feel they're different is important. And that's why I think Japanese companies are so intent on finding people, maybe not necessarily with skills, without skills. They see the inculcation of this corporate morality as a more difficult and more important job than teaching them actual skills on the line, which they feel anybody can do.
But I suppose it's relative in the sense that if you're in a company, you're expected to take on those values of that group. And so the values that you were raised with might be a little different from those.
And you're constantly
but you need
being
to conform.
Yeah, my point is just simply, do you have a source of values outside of the self? When we talk about relativism, it seems to me in American culture, we have focused on the fact that the self is autonomous, and therefore it's bad to have surface feelings, because that's not your self. You are being other-directed, or you are taking, you're saying something. Mm-hmm. Whereas, if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're suggesting is the very powerful role of, and we might not call them community, but an institution, whether it's the corporation or the faculty or the family or whatever. That, and you have this kind of, I don't know if it's split, I don't know if you're saying that there's a schizoid sense of the self, but where we have jettisoned most of that in our culture, at least I think what's being argued is that by the late 20th century, our sense of the self is much more autonomous. We are much less tolerant of those other groups imposing values. Whereas, again, if I'm hearing, correct me if I'm, but what I'm hearing you say is that the Japanese sense of the self still has a much, much more powerful sense of connection to other institutions, whether it be family or a corporation or whatnot, and you have to operate within that, and you are obligated to that, and you have a different language. Is that, am I?
I think you're right. Yeah. Yes, I'm arguing the relativity in the sense that you change your attitude according to the people that you're with, or according to the context that you're in. But I see what you're saying. Yeah. However, I just want to add one thing. Yes, there's a sense of connection to both people and institutions, and they in part determine how you act. But part of what I want to say here is I'd like all of you not to go out of the room thinking that Japanese only conform to institutions and people, because I think there are these other times in their lives when they don't. And they create times for themselves when they are able to express their own individual ideas and feelings. So that's the only thing I did.
Is this that makes them, I mean, when you go to countries that have been occupied by Japanese, they say they were terrible, cruel. So they can go back home and then just be a nice person again, because it's a different...
That seems to be the case. Of course, our soldiers have been cruel too, so that's a real tough question to deal with, how that switch happens, how somehow we categorize them over there as someone we can be brutal with and come home and not live out that brutality. Yes.
I missed your opening remarks, so if you covered this, I'm sorry, but I'm just sitting here thinking how I would just even come up with this prototype or generalization of the people I know, who are mostly Americans, and, you know, finding that that would be difficult for me. Just wondering if it's any easier if Japanese are more similar to each other than Americans.
I think you can safely say that. There is, of course, heterogeneity difference among Japanese. There's lots of different personalities, and when you're in a group, part of what's a lot of fun about it is that at these parties, as you reflected the other day, they start to bring out their individual characteristics that are really a lot of fun, and they laugh at each other. But they don't take those individual characteristics, I would say, very seriously. That's not what's supposed to determine who you are or what you do to the same extent. So it's not like the uniqueness of an individual isn't there. It is. But your point about generality is a good one. I think it's probably easier to generalize in a society where values are more accepted over a broad range. That's not to say that values aren't changing in Japan. They are. But perhaps there's less difference here. But how would you characterize self in the United States? That's what I'm starting to do up here. I thought it would be fun to make two lines here and see what we can come up with.
The Myers-Briggs test is what makes the most sense to me. And I was thinking, well, so there's 16 different types, but I know in America that there is, more of a conglomeration around the extrovert rather than the introvert, around the sensate. I'm sorry if you don't know what I'm talking about, but sensate versus intuitive. I know more Americans follow in the sensate.
Okay,
thinking,
well, let's put those down.
Feeling. I know more men fall into thinking, more women fall into feeling.
Yeah, there's gender differences that are interesting.
I think the
did
last.
Did you say intuitive is more?
No, sensate more than intuitive.
What's sensate? So. Judging according to.
So sensate is how you take in your reality through your five senses.
Oh, okay.
So if you're very focused on what you see and hear versus if you kind of, I can't explain intuitive because I don't understand that.
The Myers-Briggs test is catching on like wildfire in Japan in the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, is there any
I don't have any
falling
doubt
out of where they, I always thought, well, here Americans are all extrovert and Japanese is probably all introvert. But,
no, there's a phenomenally extroverted Japanese.
You know, aren't there regional differences in this country, too? Because when I think of some of my southern friends, and especially women, there's a traditionalism, there's a convention that seems to be expected of them, especially when they're in a formal setting. And that's even true of some of our male friends who are even far removed from the South, but there still is that conventionality. That seems to be very hard for them to disabuse.
Great point. The Japanese who are in Georgia now more and more have a feeling of affinity with the southern personality, where there are tatemae and honne, you know, what you really mean and then what you say on the surface is alive and well in the South.
Yes, indeed.
It has been for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And in that way, I've always found it difficult to really get close to a southern person and find that they themselves have something going that I don't seem to be able to break into. And,
because you want people to express what they really think? Is that your problem here?
Well, because there is a very deep and private side to the Southerner. This, of course, is a stereotype in itself. And I'm talking about people originally from Alabama. Frank Cross is what I'm thinking of here. And so when you do finally, for 10 years I didn't get to know that inner person. And when I did, I found it was very different from what was projected. Projected was absolute self-assurance and control. The inner person was very insecure and really quite emotional.
No Northerners are like that.
we come from New York, we're on here.
Both Japan and Alabama are maybe subconsciously trying to avenge defeats.
Well, there's also, I think, some norms, if you come out of the business community, there's norms of dress and there's norms of behavior and whatever, and that varies too with the type of company and the type of location geographically.
So maybe what I'm hearing is we're not as different as we sometimes think we are. Is that what I'm hearing? I mean, in some ways you can see similarities. You can understand this. We're all human enough to know what this is that I'm talking about.
Yeah, if you work in the laboratory, you come to work with, you know, your short sleeves and not a tie, but you go over to corporate headquarters and there's no one over there without a tie on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of degree, though. Mm-hmm. It's even built into the whole language, where there's a completely different way to speak. And even me, I've been living in Japan 12 years, but this faculty meeting form of Japanese, it's something that I'm still intensively studying, and it takes forever to catch on to. You just can't imagine the way they have to. Not only, as she said, there are actual verbs and words that are different words, but you also have to be careful. You can't step on anybody's toes when you speak. So the whole faculty meeting, everybody trying not to step on anyone's toes, but squeezing their opinion in between your cracks here and there, and hinting roundabout as you can possibly be, and euphemisms left and right, and it's incredible. It's another art.
So I agree, it sounds like an executive board meeting, too.
Well, maybe. I've never been there, so.
You have to get a black belt in manipulating people through words. Right? Mm. Throwing your opponent without ever touching them is not what great people masters could do.
There's a book I've read, it's called Polite Fictions, which says that to be polite in any culture, there's certain fictions that you act out.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, in America, one of the polite fictions is, you and I are friends. So when you meet someone the first time and you say goodbye, you say, wow, gee, I'm really looking forward to seeing you again. And you turn around and think, God, I never want to see him again. But you put on that fiction, you put your arm around them, you shake hands, and that just doesn't go over in Japan. Because the polite fiction in Japan, the fiction when you meet someone is, you are greater than I, and I am lesser than you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you play that fiction in America, people think, God, this
right, it's the egalitarian yeah. fiction that we...
He doesn't yeah. have any confidence so in himself,
or what's he want?
What's he after, you know, buttering me up.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
nobody feels that in Japan. That's mm-hmm. the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's polite.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great...
Well, it's yeah. an interesting book, and so there's an elaborate culture of how to put someone up and how to put yourself down,
mm-hmm.
and it's built into the language extensively.
This is sort of a change of subject, but going along on this a little farther, I heard some people talking, and they were from European countries here at Holden, and they were saying to each other, I feel like I should put a sign on front of me that says, I'm from such and such a country, I used to work at such and such a place, I'm retired now, you know, because these were the questions that, boom, 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 they got asked as soon as they sat down with somebody. And they were saying, why, in my country, that would just be rude to ask all those questions. And that really made me think about what we do. To us, perhaps it's rude if someone doesn't ask those questions, but yet that can seem over-penetrating to some other cultures.
Do you trace this back to the emperor cult? I think, as you mentioned, that protocol,
mm-hmm.
That this is exactly what the vizier teaches the heir to the throne.
I wouldn't trace it back to that. I would probably trace uh-huh. the emperor cult back to cultural values.
Okay,
such as
so
this,
at any rate, this stuff goes
yeah.
all the way back to a very traditional society.
Oh, the deference to emperor, right.
Because mm-hmm. When Amun has done his duty up in Asia and comes back to Memphis, to the Pharaoh, he says, I am nothing but a dog. When I see you, my ka leaves me. And, you know, he is reduced to absolutely nothing in the presence of his mm-hmm. king.
Well, certainly that's true in Japan, too. The most polite language is reserved for the emperor. Yeah. Right.
But few people ever speak to the
right, so they don't have to worry
no,
about
but what
it.
I mean is then that carries down to
yeah.
all other
right.
relative
but,
relationships too.
I mean, there are times when the emperor hasn't been very important in Japan. During the Tokugawa times when they were, they blocked off themselves from the rest of the world, there was a shogun, of course, so there was still a hierarchy. The emperor was kept in his castle, kept in his imperial palace away from everyone else. And then there was a resurgence of that leading through Meiji, through the time of militarization and industrialization up to World War II, and that's when the emperor cult really got developed very strongly and ran down as a hierarchy and a big family hierarchy through all of Japanese society. So that really got played up at that point. Yeah. Yeah, you want to
say. A Japanese woman told me that friendships in Japan, you have fewer and they're deep. And here, everybody has many friends, but they're so shallow.
I've heard this a lot, too, and I'm glad you brought that up. A lot of Japanese will say, I feel so lonely in this culture. So that there may be only a few people that you share those really private inner thoughts with in Japan, but it runs very deep and it goes throughout your life. Yeah, that's a good point.
How well did the Japanese adapt themselves to losing the war and having to become Americanized to some extent? And then how long did it take to change? Have they changed?
I don't think so. The American occupation did make a lot of changes, and most of those have been undone in some way or another. I mean, you can make a lot of examples, like they decentralized education, it's been re-centralized. They tried to wipe out antitrust, and antitrust sort of, or rather, situations of collusion go on anyway.
The laws are on the books, and people realize that there's a good intent there, and they are occasionally brought to court, but very seldom. What we would consider blatant antitrust practices happen every day.
But if you talk about Americanization, I would think that the way that's happening is through consumer culture as much as anything. And the magazines, as I mentioned the other day, are full of ideas of, if you buy this product, you can be an individual. You can find your own style. You can express yourself. And so that idea of becoming more of an individual is expressed through the consumer culture. Of course, we get some of that ourselves, I think, with the magazines we buy and feeling like we're going to be more unique if we buy a certain thing. However, I feel that consumer thrust is limited in Japanese society to young women particularly, or more generally to women buying household goods and so on. So the idea of an individual expressing themselves, yeah, it's still okay, but it's still limited. It's becoming more okay, I should say, but it's still limited in certain contexts. And so in the household, or if your main place of work is the company, you still are much more limited in the American individualism that you can express. Now, this is an interesting idea. Individualism is the way that the U.S., Americans are usually described as autonomous, as individual, as not caring about relations particularly, as not conforming to the group or conforming to the situation. What do you think about that? When you hear about Japanese, I mean, do you feel that they're very, very different from us and that we don't have that? You're shaking your head. What do you think?
No, I was just...
Oh, you're just thinking. Okay.
I'm just thinking. Shake my head.
Shaking the boxes.
I wonder if it's something that we tend to think is a subconscious, it's like this sociological rearing of a person that is subconscious, whereas the Japanese take it for granted and it's nothing to be ashamed of.
Which isn't?
That you are a product of your environment or you are a product of your society.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to rebel
so
against that.
You're saying that it still happens, but we're denying it. Is that what you said?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You're saying that we all are a product of the group or environment that we've been raised by. We try to deny it. They don't feel ashamed of it and aren't expressing
it. All what you said about education, that there's emphasis just on rote learning, whereas in our country there's much more emphasis on sort of synthetic approach and combining creativity, originality. It seems that you could see a correlation between the educational systems and these two behavioral types, because
yeah,
if the person in our educational system is thought already as a youngster to read a poem and to ask, well, what's the poem mean to me, rather than just memorize it and give it back, that person may also look deeply also inside of self and say, I'm not going to just read back a behavioral pattern because this is what I discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So an emphasis on originality also in the way one behaves.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is a correlation?
Oh yeah, I do.
And
I think that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why Japanese are thinking they want to change their education system, because they'd like some more of this individuality or innovativeness and things.
And it'll be interesting to see if then you will have a concomitant change in what you're describing by way of contrast.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a word that comes up often. I'm sorry.
That's great. Go ahead.
Yeah. People often use the word common sense. Well, that's common sense. Oh, you shouldn't do that. It's common sense.
And in Japan.
In Japan. So it just seems to be everywhere. There's this kind of code of behavior or common knowledge.
That everyone shares.
Everyone shares.
Much more shared. I mean, there are regional differences, and there are differences by socioeconomic level to some extent, but not to the same extent as in our own country. Yeah, you want to say?
Do you have a sense that questions like the good life or the purpose of life or the meaning of life or what is virtuous behavior or a virtuous life, is that still a part of the conversation about how the self is defined in Japan?
You mean for them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, there are. No matter when you look, there'll be a dozen bestsellers on the shelf about who are we Japanese? You know, where are we going? What is good for us? What's the meaning of my life? What's the meaning of life at 20? What's the meaning at 30? What's the meaning at 40, 50, 60, 70, and everything? So it occupies a lot of print and a lot of talk.
In the print, then, is there a fair consensus as to what those are, or is that a question open for discussion, as it might be in this country where, you know, when you say what's the good life at 30 in Japan, do you have a lot of competing voices in that, or is it fairly traditional? And it's pretty well known when you're at 30 what you ought to be doing, what you ought to be conforming to. In a sense,
we have a book with exactly that title: "What You Ought to Be Doing at 30." For my money, I don't know a lot of these things. A lot of it comes down to the book identifying all the things which are important at 30, which are impacting your life, where you're going in your career, where you've been, physical change, and you know, childbearing, and so on. But it often comes down to organizing your key privately and getting a hold of yourself in terms of inner discipline. I imagine that recommendation is pretty much always going to be there. And so that sometimes the solutions that are given are remarkably consistent. Am I wrong?
No,
I'm not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How important is religion in Japanese life?
You put it in here.
How important is religion?
Could there be a Japanese holy place?
It would be very different. Someone has written about something that might be sort of like a Japanese holy. No, to your first question. Religion, of course, is very different to begin with in Japan, but there isn't the kind of sense of going to a church on Sunday or any day of the week, or of being part of a community. It's you belong to a temple, so you'll have somewhere to be buried, and you and someone to bury you. And even for marriage, you don't depend on it much. You go to a marriage palace, as they call them, and they have a Shinto priest who comes there and marries you. So there's not an ongoing sense of religion in very many people's lives, but there are some new religions, sort of evangelistic from a Buddhist point of view, that some people have joined up with. So that's a movement that is not strong, but it's there. Those people have trouble getting jobs, however. Okay, the rest of your question?
Could that be a chaplain? How would
Oh, yeah, right, the spirit, okay. Well, this one retreat center that someone wrote about was one that small businesses sent their employees to get a hold of their spirit, to make their key stronger. And some of the things they did there, I'll tell you the more extreme, I suppose. It was a very disciplined life. Get up at a certain time, everybody has to make their bed. If you come up and inspect the room, if the inspector comes up and one bed isn't made, then everybody has to go back up and make their beds again. So very much a group emphasis. At night, they do Zen meditation, which of course is kneeling with your knees like this, and this gets very painful after a while, and they have to do that for several hours at a time. Again, focusing on the key, bringing it together, trying to get it stronger and under control. The extreme of that was one night when they were led out into a field and had to do that kneeling on rocks in their bare legs.
They paid a lot of money for this.
They paid a lot of money for it, yeah. And when they did this, they played or sang a song about their mother. And this is a real interesting way of motivating people in Japan. And this is part of several therapies that are used in Japan. where you go back and feel that debt of gratitude to your parents and your teachers, particularly the mother, however. And that you feel your guilt so much that maybe, you know, at first you get to the point where you want to kill yourself. You feel that guilt so much and debt so much. But then you come around with the guidance of the teacher and so on to the point where you want to go on because of that. You have this debt to repay, and so you want to do well in society. So that's, you know, a very different motivating factor than we think about. But very tied in with the family and with society. And that can go to Japan, too, I'd say. Not just mother, but Japan. It can go out that far. Yeah, so that's the kind of spiritual retreat.
Thank you. How seriously can they be taking this blood typing where they pigeonhole people for certain jobs? I've been reading about that.
Well, what have you read? I know they characterize people according to blood type. But
just in a nutshell, I remember type O was an achiever, type A is a deep thinker, B is creative, and AB is problem solver. So if they need certain kinds of people for their corporation, how many people are looking for that?
Good.
I've seen that in company magazines. This month's company magazine will feature the payroll section, and they're all in there with their, you know, height, weight, what school they graduated from, how would they describe themselves, and that's a little whimsical, and blood type will be in there. For what it's worth, I've never heard it suggested that means anything.
There's lots of astrology, too.
Saying I'm a Sagittarius, you know, that may tell you something about me, it may not.
Yeah, you have come.
No, in the corporate world, we do a lot of the same kinds of things. You know,
the spiritual retreat stuff?
Yeah, that type of thing. You know, go off the Pecos River or something, and you start climbing the rocks together, and doing the ropes courses and all that thing, trying to build teamwork out of it. And we come, you know, we're all products in a way of our environment. Some of the tapes, you were what you were when. You are what you know, what you were when, what you grew up in, home, and a lot of your values and directions are formed in a very early age. Things kind of stay with you. So, you know, we do a lot of similar kinds of things.
Yeah, I think that probably this difference between Japan as completely group-oriented and us as completely individualistic has been stretched to an extreme. And if there's any simple thing I want you to go away with is that probably we're not as individualistic as we are sometimes put out to be. I think we probably put more stress on relationships than we're giving credit for. But the Japanese also aren't as group-oriented as we're always led to believe either. Okay, we'll end there.
Thank you.